Barbara Collins, PhD in genetics and botany, professor at the University at California Lutheran College.
The potential, there are only three possibilities as far as the fertilized embryo. This would be substance, energy, and information. Substance and energy, the fertilized cell is obviously not large, has negligible energy, but the question has been, what about the potential? What about the information, so to speak? In other words, the fertilized egg has within it a nucleus that is a potential for another human being. Whether you know it or not, almost all the cells in your body likewise have a nucleus that has the potential for another human being. So if the fertilized egg in this respect is not terribly different from perhaps other cells in the body. Nevertheless, the fertilized egg does have the so-called DNA, does have the potential information. Let me read first a few things that, again, Garrett Hardin has said concerning this, and he likens the fertilized egg to a set of blueprints for a house. In other words, it's the information, it is the potential. And he says, consider the case of a man who's about to begin to build a $50,000 house. And he has the blueprints here. Supposing a joker burns up the blueprint, suppose he then brings it to the court and sues the man, is he going to collect $50,000 for his burned blueprint? Well, probably not. A set of blueprints is not a house, and the DNA of a zygote is not a human being, and then so on. Then the anomaly of the human information problem is connected with the fact that the information that is destroyed in an aborted embryo is unique, unlike the house blueprint, but it is unique in a way that is without moral significance. A favorite argument of abortion prohibitionists is this. What if Beethoven's mother had had an abortion? The question moves us, but when we think it over, we realize we can just as relevantly ask, what if Hitler's mother had had an abortion? Each conceptus is unique, but not in any way that has a moral consequence. The expected potential value of each aborted child is exactly that of the average child born. It is meaningless to say that humanity loses when a particular child is not born or is not conceived. A human female at birth has about 30,000 eggs in her ovaries. If she bears only three children in her lifetime, is there any meaningful sense in which we can say that mankind has suffered a loss in those other 29,997 fruitless eggs? Yet one of them might have been a super Beethoven. Incidentally, these came out of this book, Population, Evolution, and Birth Control. This has been assembled by Garrett Hardin, and he has some articles written by people in a sort of a historical development of the particular idea. In closing, I would like to just ask you four or five questions I think, again, bear on this problem. First off, concerning the question of abortion, it is rather of interest that the particular problem really concerns women, and it is the woman who is pregnant is the woman who has to carry the child, wanted, unwanted, or otherwise. Whatever her reasons, psychological or otherwise, nevertheless, it is she who is pregnant, and the rules have been made by the state and by men, and she is bound by these particular rules. Supposing now a particular woman does feel that it is right to have an abortion, whatever her reason is, maybe the probabilities of her having a deformed child are extremely high, or some reason or other. She feels that for her an abortion is necessary. what are the alternatives? If the state says, no, you cannot have an abortion, what happens? Does this mean that she then is forced to carry the child who could possibly be a hydrocephalic or otherwise? I think in many cases the thing that results is she goes to the black market. If she has money, she'll go to Hawaii. She will go someplace where she can have the abortion. If she has no money, what then? Is it fair, is it right that some people should, can, if you have money, get the abortion? Again, if you go to the black market, what are the chances of your having a kind of abortion that you live afterwards? Maybe you start hemorrhaging, then they let you into the hospital. Is it fair that you have to start hemorrhaging before they let you into the hospital? Again, I feel that if a woman really wants an abortion, she will probably get it, even if it's doing it herself and endangering her life. So perhaps maybe by saying that no one can have an abortion, perhaps we may be creating more of a problem as far as life is concerned. Another factor in considering this, supposing you knew that you had a child that would very likely be malformed or mentally deficient, is it right to have this to be born? It is a well-known fact that if an abortion is properly performed in an early stage, the chances of getting pregnant within the next 2 or 3 months are perhaps even better than they might have been before. Wouldn't it be better perhaps at a very early stage, particularly for a woman who is carrying this child for 9 months? I can't imagine having to carry a child for 9 months with the fear every day of thinking, this is going to be a hydrocephalic and what am I going to do when it's born? If at an early stage you could have the abortion, then you could be pregnant in 2 or 3 months and feel this is going to be, you know, a healthy child, one that can contribute to society. One other thing I would just like to mention concerning the fertilized egg and information. The fertilized egg is living, yes. So too is the unfertilized egg. So too is the sperm. All of these are living things. All of them have information. And even so too are other cells of the body. They are living. The unfertilized egg is just as living, really, as the fertilized egg and the sperm. We have not suddenly created life out of unlife. It is a gradual development and change that occurs as this goes along. And I don't feel that suddenly when the sperm enters the egg that there is suddenly a soul, and that this is something different. It is a very gradual process that occurs. In some plants, development, and actually some animals, development occurs without fertilization. In other words, it is a change, an environmental factor that also contributes. And it is not necessarily the doubling of the chromosomes by the entrance of the sperm that is always necessary for this development.
Thank you. The next in our alphabetical order is Dr. Ivan, who spoke to us also yesterday. He's a professor of biology at Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa. And he also explained to us his own credentials for involvement in the ecological issues. So I'll introduce him now. Dr. Ivan.
List of items here, but as I go down the list, I think Barbara's hit most of them. I guess this is the trouble with having two biologists on the panel. If you've listened to me yesterday, you know that I'm rather hung up on the population problem. And I hate to admit that we are in a position in the world where we have to fall back on a method as primitive as abortion for limiting our numbers. I certainly, as a biologist and as a father, I wouldn't want to see this happen. You see, as a biologist, I don't have any particular trouble with abortion. I go along 100% with the things Barbara has brought out. But as a father, you know, it still bothers you a little bit. In our own case, I think I mentioned yesterday that we have 3 children. I feel it's too many. I really don't know what the decision would be if my wife became pregnant again. This would be a very upsetting decision to make. So maybe what I can do is maybe interject a personal part here. You see, on the one hand, I would be confronted with what I have been telling people, how invariably in another generation, if population isn't limited, we're going to have suffering beyond imagination in this world. And you see, I'd be in the position of being a little bit inconsistent. You see, here would be a potential child that I wouldn't guarantee any quality of existence. You see, this would be a rather sticky decision for me, wouldn't it? Another point I would like to make is this. There are nations in the world that have achieved a stable population. Some of them, or one example that is oftentimes mentioned, is Ireland. Ireland achieved this two ways. First of all, late marriages, which I mentioned yesterday, and also it's a little bit misleading because Ireland has exported people so that their population has tended to remain stable. Another, what I was getting at is another nation that has or approached a stable level of population growth is Japan. And they did this primarily by legalizing abortion. Until recently, when they decided that for economic purposes it was necessary that they not encourage a stable population. I understand the population of Japan is taking a radical upturn, and this in view of the limited space and limited resources of this small island. You see, here is an economic decision bearing down on people, encouraging people to have more children. But let's face it then, right now, we need a backup method of birth control. Now, as I say, I hate to say that we have to rely on abortion for population control. I hate to see us in this position. But the thought has occurred to me that this may be a price that we have to pay for the sins of our fathers. It may be the lesser of two evils. What are these sins of our fathers that we have to pay for? Number one, they have been somewhat remiss in realizing the implications of an unchecked population growth. And number two, as I mentioned yesterday, we have poured millions and billions into death control without looking at the implications of this in terms of population. We have spent very little on birth control. Perhaps if we had spent a tenth of what we spent on death control, on birth control, we wouldn't be in this position today. Maybe at this point in history now, we'll start to put a little money into research, into methods of birth control that are acceptable to other ones so that we don't have to look at something like abortion as an alternative. Now, essentially, I would say I agree with practice. Well, I agree 100% with the points that Barbara brought up. Secondly, as a father, I have reservations. It would be a very difficult decision for me. Thirdly, let's be consistent in the United States. We are going to ask undeveloped countries to limit their population. If we say these countries are the ones in the world that have a population problem, and they have to go into methods of birth control, including such things as abortion. Let's be consistent in this country. Let's have abortion as a backup method in our own country. Now, maybe what I've said is a little bit crude this morning. I'm not not always the best at getting my ideas across. I hope maybe some other aspects of what I said will come out in discussion. So I feel I said enough yesterday. I think I'll be glad to go at that then this morning. Go on to the next one.
Thank you, Dr. Ivan. Next is a close personal friend of mine, Father Peter Hagel. He is from college which I attended, Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, and is the Newman Apostolate Priest in that community. He represents a minority opinion today, and when I approached him about coming here, I led him to believe that he would not be alone representing this position. However, I failed in getting someone else on the panel with him, so I will apologize to him for making him stand up to all of us alone, but I think he's able to the test. Father Hagel.
The moderator is Chuck Langley, who is the Lutheran Student Movement Chairman for the conference for the week.
Thank you, Chuck. Ever since I've arrived here at Holden, I've been lied to. Last night, my associate I were told that there was we'd be coffee over at Clonania House. We desperately sought out the coffee pot to no avail. And then we were told, well, it's over in the kitchen. We went to the kitchen was all locked up. We said we were told it would be served during the during that World Federation meeting. No coffee was served. Even before I got here, I guess I was lied to, right, Jeff? That's all right. I don't represent a minority. I'm a loner. You know, if only there were three of us. I think I'm not quite the middle. I'm on the last half end of this panel. And I think it's time for just a psychological rest here. Do you know what the parsonage we're in, Lewis, the Catholic priest, do you know what that is called? It's a home for unwed fathers. Oh, isn't it rather ironic also that an unmarried man should take such a staunch stand on an issue which one would think is primarily a feminist issue. And yet it really is not. It's an issue which concerns the woman, yes, very definitely. But it concerns every male also, because we are all members of a society on which this issue has a tremendous impact. Therefore, all of us should be concerned about it. Now, quite frankly, I can stand here before you opposed to abortion, not as a priest, not even as a Catholic, not even as a Christian. I believe there are sufficient grounds be opposed to abortion simply as a concerned citizen. Some of the very fundamental considerations have already been mentioned when looking at this question of abortion. Really, and I don't want me to oversimplify, and I know it's not just this simple, but I think there are three basic questions we must ask ourselves and examine, investigate. And when we have the information on these questions, then I think we can arrive at a conclusion. First of all, what is human life? What is human life? What is it exactly that distinguishes it from mere animal life or vegetative life? Secondly, when does human life begin? Is it at the moment of conception, when sperm meets ovum? 2 weeks later, 3 weeks, 4 months, 6 months, point of viability, after birth, or at the moment of birth, the first breath? When does human life begin? And thirdly, is human life sacred? Meaning that once it does begin, let's not worry yet about when it begins, but once it does begin, does it have an inalienable right to exist? Nobody would question the fact that this gentleman here is a human being. And I don't think there's one among us who would deny that he has an inalienable right to exist. No one can take this man's life from him, justify it. Innocent human life has an absolute, and that, of course, is controverted, denied. But we believe, or I believe, that it is an absolute right to exist, regardless of circumstances. Circumstances cannot justify the taking of this man's innocent life. So those three basic questions. Now, I approach it this way. When does human life begin? I don't know. St. Augustine didn't know. Let's let the people who should be most qualified to tell us that, let's listen to them. Who are they? I say the scientists, the biologists, medical doctors. At this point, I'd like to recommend to you, I think, one of the finest works that I've read on abortion. It does not reach a conclusion. It simply gives the information that must be considered in arriving at a conclusion about abortion. And it's called The Terrible Choice, The Abortion Dilemma, a thorough exploration of opinions and facts on every aspect of the most devastating moral question of our age. It is based on the proceedings of the International Conference on Abortion, sponsored by the Harvard Divinity School and the Joseph P. Kennedy Foundation. Now, the reason I appreciate this book is that right now we can listen to our doctors in this country, or even locally, to our doctors in the state of Washington, and we are going to be influenced, or I believe they are going to be influenced, by the issue at stake right now. I like this because it's an international view, drawing upon the experiences of other nations that have had abortion legalized for some time. Here we're just beginning. And I think it's important that we get something out of the experience of other countries. So I'd just like to consider these three questions. What is human life? When does it begin? Is it sacred? We have always been told that it is really the soul of man, or the life principle, intellect and will, that distinguishes man from the mere animal, from the dog, the cat, and everything else. Intellect and will. Biologically, we have animal life within us. That's not much different than cows and other species of animals. But it's our intellect and will that make us different. Now, when does this begin, therefore? Now, we've mentioned here this morning that human life, or we are really humanized, at least this is the way I learned it, through the social, psychosocial interaction. We become human through education. We are made human by society. I would have to disagree with this. Or to me, honestly, but I have to disagree. As that little baby is being held up by the doctor, patted on the butt, to take its first breath, who's going to deny that this is a human being? And this kid hasn't had one day of school yet, hasn't had been influenced yet in one way or another by society, and yet this is still a human being. Yes, what I don't like about that principle, really, and perhaps later on, the one responsible for exposing this view would answer my question. At what point then, therefore, if it is psychosocial interaction that makes us human, at what point do we become human? Age 6, first grade? 10? And would it not be logical to conclude that until that happened, therefore, we could exterminate those who have not been yet humanized through psychosocial interaction? Anyway, I believe that human life is determined by the very fact of intellect and will, which is present even in the, at least in potential, in the unborn child. When does it begin? I'd say, let me say this. Now, regarding the Catholic Church, she has what is a moral principle, what is known as tutsir pars. And her position really comes about because of this moral principle called tutsir pars, which simply means that when you have a serious issue at stake, and there is doubt involved, there is no clear-cut answer, and there is reasonable doubt involved, then we take the safer course. That's what tutsir pars means, the safer course. And just common sense, really, it's a common sense principle. We follow this all the time. Let's say this gentleman and I, we go out deer hunting.
The tape becomes bad at this point and is inaudible for this side until we get midway into the dress of Dr. David Hampton, a considerable portion long on the tape. It becomes clearer, although the overtape still mars the production. Merely use the fast forward until you find where you can listen to the distinct tape from this side.
Scientists are often accused of being rather matter of fact about things like living things. That is, scientists that are not biologists. And I am not a biologist. But I should like to remind you that
the person who you can hear in the background now and become more distinct in a bit is Dr. David Hampton.
Witness a live birth of my first son. I was very impressed by this event. I believe human life is sacred, and And I would concur with Albert Schweitzer's statement. So I don't think that we're too far off there. But I think that I have to come back to the situation. I don't want to get into an argumentative position here because we have set aside time for this, and I know you're all anxious to have coffee. And I know how I am right before coffee time. I'm very fidgety. And so I feel like I'm in a bad position here trying to say too much. But I have had the opportunity to read a book recently entitled Who Shall Live? A Man's Control Over Birth and Death. And I've also had the opportunity to talk to some of the people who have worked on this kind of thing, that is sensitivity about life and human existence. This book was a report prepared by the American Friends Service Committee. And I've known several members of the Friends organization or persuasion. I have been deeply impressed by their sensitivity towards the reverence for human life and for human existence. Sometimes it's made me so angry I could walk out of the room. I had participated in a War and Peace course. It's an interdisciplinary course at Wartburg College. And I often thought I made the mistake, but I did invite two friends who were very interested in the issue of war into my discussion sessions. And their barb-like questions that came to students, you know, about reverence of human life and reverence of existence. And the witness that they have in terms of serving those people who have been injured in war, especially children, tell me something about their persuasion, that they are deeply concerned about human existence. And this booklet was prepared as a study manual because there is a dilemma within the organization about abortion. And I would like to read from this just a section on chapter 5. I'm not going to read the whole chapter. But chapter 5, it's entitled The Good Life. And here's what the good life means to friends. To friends, a good life means much more. That is, more than adequate food, shelter, and clothing, physical and mental health, loving and being loved, and so on. It means, in addition, the opportunity to develop in mind, personality, and body to one's fullest potential. It means access to education and a healthy environment. It means a chance to grow up with dignity and self-respect in a family that encourages personal and social responsibility and helpfulness to others. It means a life in which man can make responsible use of his powers, physical, intellectual, creative, social, and spiritual. Now, yesterday you heard somebody tell about what life would be like with six people living on a spot about that big. These curves are called exponential curves, incidentally. They aren't doubling curves, they're exponential. They're fantastic, they're logarithmic curves. And when you think of a rocket leaving the launching pad, for example, and think about its acceleration, how it's changing from zero all the way up to 17,000 or more miles per hour. This is what we're watching, you see. In terms of the actual length of time of the Earth, well, you've heard this. In terms of the actual length of existence of the Earth, we're just about 1 minute to midnight in terms of the existence of the Earth, in terms of civilization. Now, what does a philosophy like... I hope I'm not being unfair to this. Did you say Tootsie or Parr? Yeah, okay. What does a philosophy like Tootsie or Parr have to say to this kind of a time scale? This is a very grave problem in my mind. I have several points here, but the one that just keeps coming to the forefront is the thing that's been repeated over and over again. The fact that we have right at present a very grave population problem coupled with a
limited source of natural resources. We have an ecological dilemma, and you realize this, and in view of this, how can we support Tutsiyar Par? Now, we were told by Dr. Iben that we can either cut down the birth rate or we can increase the death rate. These produce very serious questions about human life, and these have been pursued very well by the members of the panel. I'd like to point out that family planning is not working, that overpopulation and quality of life could lead to international tension and worldwide destruction, that abortion is being carried on at the predicted rate of 60 million each year, that there are 10,000 legal abortions in the United States, and there are over 1 million total abortions in the United States. The essentials, however, are always getting back to that problem of quality of human life as described in this booklet, which I can recommend to you, and that is, what is human life? And so with that, I'd like to simply let you go have some coffee, and then we'll get into some of the particulars of abortion and maybe be able to examine different positions here in the panel. Thank you.
We're not going to have coffee the way we have it. Since the dining hall is disabled with the dishwasher out, we're not going to impose any more things on them. If you want coffee, I'd ask you to go to the snack bar, and you can get a cup of coffee there for a nickel. I think that we will not break the session here because we do have to be out of this room before 10:30 for the music portion, and I think that we'll be best to continue right now and then take the regular coffee break with the rest of the village. So if you want coffee, why don't you just go quietly on your own and get some, and we'll have some time for questions. Before we have questions from the floor, if the panel would like, I would like to give them opportunities.
Dr. Baker is the first speaker.
And I ask you again, please, to do this quietly so that we can continue. Our time is getting short now.
The arguments you read in the books are practical in nature. They concern themselves with overpopulation. They concern themselves with the health of a mother, mental, physical, or otherwise. Sometimes with the potential health of the unborn child. Perhaps most people are concerned about these problems. Father Hagel obviously is concerned about overpopulation, concerned about the health of mothers and so on. So this is not the real issue of controversy. The issue of controversy is what are we going to do about that, and what most people are trying to find is some kind of a moral justification to do what their reason tells them they ought to do. Our reason tells us that we ought to permit abortions. Now, what I'm trying to suggest here is that there is a philosophical, a religious, a theological justification for abortions. It has to do with the questions Father Hagel himself raised, beginning with the question of what is life? When does it begin? Is it sacred? The biologists have told us that it's a foolish question to ask, when does life begin? It doesn't. It always has been. It is. It is not something that starts at some point in time. It isn't something that begins in the union of sperm and ovum. As was pointed out by Dr. Collins, the ovum is very much alive. There could not have been fertilization if the ovum were not alive. The progeneration of species by cloning is a live possibility. In some lower animal forms, a cell taken from subcutaneous tissue has been successfully developed into a low-level form. Life was there, life is not something that begins. So we can dispense with that question. When the question is raised, it usually connotes the idea that there's something special about human life. And so the question of when does it begin is usually raised in connection with when can we call it human. Now this supposes, you see, that the human species is something different from other species. And let me speak then briefly to that. Let me point out first, I think that the human animal is no different in kind from other animals. What is it that we call the soul? Well, it has to do with the intellect, the will, the capacity to worship. All of these shared by nearly all other animal forms. The chimpanzee has an intellect, obviously lower than mine, I think, usually. But it's different not in kind, but in degree. Whatever else we may think the mind is, it is a function of the neurological system. If we had no neurological system, we'd have no mind. The mind isn't something that there's a sort of an entity all by itself that gets pushed into the body. It's a function of the total organism, centering in the neurological system. Mental functioning, the intellective capacity, varies greatly, not only among various species, but within a given species, all because of the variation in development of the neurological system. We well know that a baby who is deprived of adequate protein will be denied a full intellective functioning because his neurological system simply will not develop to the place where he has a mind that is capable of adequate action. The capacity to worship is not unique to the human species. Anybody who has a pet dog knows that dogs can worship. Worship is merely the giving of the self in devotion to something one considers to be higher than himself. You see, what I'm saying is that the human life is something that operates, proceeds upon the development of the organism which we have and becomes different in degree. And we call it then the humanization. Now he raised the question, then when does this begin? After the child goes to school, there's a great deal of psychosocial interaction before the child is born. We know that prenatal development, the prenatal environment, is very crucial. When the child is born, obviously this is a human being, in every real sense of that word, and obviously that human being is a sacred entity, just as sacred as any other. It obviously is not yet fully human in the same sense that he will be later on, but he certainly has the capacity for it and is well along the way in that process. This process began, however, before he was born in the very highly complex but very significant and important kinds of interactions that take place prenatally. Now, obviously, before the child has the full organic capacity to react and interact environmentally, psychosocially, it is only a potential human being. Potential in the same sense that the unfertilized ovum is potential, but nonetheless, only potential. If one needs then to fix a point in time, until the embryo becomes a fetus, it is not human. It is merely a potential human organism or organism of the human species. If we wish, if it's necessary to fix a time, then we can fix a time at that point in which the embryonic development has been completed and the fetus is then capable of interacting prenatally towards the development of the human self. Chuck, Yes.
The next speaker is Ms. Kathy Stick, S-T-I-C-K, Lutheran Student Movement Secretary.
I'd kind of like to speak to you first as a student, and then as a woman, and then as a nurse midwife. And my professional role is to do family counseling, prescribe birth control pills. I have done a lot of counseling as far as women who want abortions, and I have also been there the night before, the morning of, and the day after an abortion, and also during labor and delivery of an unwanted baby. It seems like this morning we've been dealing with the issue totally on a very scientific, objective level. You know, this is my interpretation, and I don't think it can be handled that way. First of all, you asked the question, when does life begin? I can't really give you a very scientific answer about that, but I can give you what my patients tell me, and that's life begins for them when they feel that baby move. And before that, it's just, you know, it's just a thing growing. Again, this may not be true for every woman, but this has been my experience. One of my recent experiences, which I'd like you to think about and consider, this is a 21-year-old white girl who came to our clinic thinking she was pregnant. And after we'd taken her history and examined her, she was pregnant. And in pinning down when the conception had possibly taken place, she'd spent approximately 2 months on LSD trips every other night. And I'm sure you're all well aware of the possibility of what LSD can do to the human embryo. We did a lot of counseling and talking, you know, with her about, you know, how she would feel about it, how the father of the baby would feel about it, even though she wasn't married, because it's a decision for him to be made, too. He was interested. And it was decided that she, you know, if she wanted, could have an abortion. She decided not to. But this is just, you know, one of the things she, you know, she had the option. Many places you don't have the option, and you'd have to carry that baby. And that baby was malformed. This is not to say her decision was right or her decision was wrong. That's what happened. On the other hand, I've been there when patients have made the decision to have an abortion. And this was she must have been, I think, 16 as I remember right now. And I came into her room the night before surgery, and she was crying. And she was a rather mature girl, and this, you know, kind of surprised me because we had talked, and I thought she'd, you know, pretty well come to a conclusion about how she, you know, what she wanted and how she was feeling. And this, you know, so we talked some more, and she said she was having guilt feelings is what it was. You know, do I have a right, you know, to make this decision and destroy this life? But on the other hand, do I have a right to bring this life into the world where it may not have much of a chance? She says, I couldn't give it up, but I don't know what kind of a life I can offer it. There's a whole gambit of things that have to be taken into consideration, both, you know, as a student, as a woman, and then for us who deal with it professionally. And I think that, well, just in my opinion, I think a woman deserves the option to make the decision. And I'm probably leaving myself wide open, but this is mainly based on what I have seen professionally. You know, not everybody is going to be happy no matter which way the decision is made. And if you want to ask me questions or anything, just let me know, okay? Individual basis, because you can't say, you know, the baby's going to move at 4 months old, you know. It varies quite a bit. But from what my patients have told me, this is when they say, you know, that they can really comprehend that there is a new life growing within inside them. Any other comments?
Okay, I think we're ready for some questions from the floor. There is some coffee if you want to slip over there and get it if you're not opposed to using the styrofoam cups. Some people are because they say they won't break down.
The next speaker is Miss Thalia Cady, Thalia Cady. She relates how her mother had a child and she died a very painful death at 6.5 months. Thalia Cady.
Which may very possibly be hereditary. The child died a very painful death at the age of 6 months. Now I'm married, and I'm going to have to face the fact that if I bring a child into the world, the child may very possibly die. I don't see where it is a necessary evil, or necessarily could be called an evil, that I practice birth control. If I got pregnant for 9 months, I would worry and fear and probably pray a lot that my child would not die the way my mother's did. And I can't see where it's an evil for me to want to protect the life of my unborn children. I can't see where practicing birth control and very possibly having an abortion if I become pregnant is an evil. If I value human life so much that I consider even the life of my unborn children. Father Hagel, if you have anything to say about this, I'd appreciate it.
Father Hagel.
I recognize the position that you could be in personally. I also admit that we do have a problem, a population problem, personal problems such as this, with which I empathize completely and totally. But I always point out, or try to point out, I see a vast difference, an essential difference, between birth control, with which I have no hang-up whatsoever. I see a difference between preventing life. But I see that as a completely different question than destroying it once it does exist. You see, one is there's no life there. You're not allowing life to come into existence, which I think we must do. The human species must do this. We must begin to control and achieve population zero. I'll go along with that. If this is what the scientists say we must do for the survival of the human species, fine, great. Let's all practice birth control.
There's more to it than just that. For if I did become pregnant, I would seriously consider abortion because I do value human life. Whether, you know, if I were 3 months pregnant, I'd still be considering it, you know?
Yes, I see. You would. She said if she became pregnant, she'd still have to consider the human life. But then I say it's a completely different question, you see. And then here is where you have to let your conscience be your guide in this thing.
But a little earlier in your discussion, you said, you know,
yes, I was very much faced with a similar decision. My sister, who was several years older than I am, a couple of years, she's a young woman in the prime of life. And I and several of my other brothers and sisters had to make the decision regarding a brain surgery also. It's a different question, but you know, I realize people, and especially women, are put on the spot. I don't know how many of you saw the movie The Cardinal, you know, where this priest was put on the spot regarding the decision of abortion. But I was in a similar position. This type of surgery might do this. It might leave my sister a vegetable. If we did this, she could die. If we did this, we don't know what would happen. And the neurologist, more or less, what are you going to do? So we had to make that decision. That decision you would also have to make. But personally now, and I do not believe that I can impose my views on you, all I would hope that my presence at a panel such as this is that at least you have heard the other side of how other people think and feel. And this is personally how my conviction that It's a different question, birth control, abortion. Two different questions. No problem with birth control. I think we need it. Abortion, here we are entering into where we have to make the decision whether we are going to appropriate to ourselves dominion over life. Now, and I might add in this also, I would like to thank Dr. Baker for clarifying his position there, but I would still have problems with that. And I'll ask another question here. You know, if human life is no different than animal life, what is it then? What's this Christianity all about? What is it that we have that no one else, no other animal has? What is it that we're trying to save by our living on the face of this earth, namely our souls? There is something different about us. We are not just animals. We have an eternal dimension. This is what my faith tells me, my philosophy. Now, I don't know whether I answered your question now, but I just see two different questions. You are then put on the spot regarding abortion, and then you're going to have to follow the dictates of your principles, whether you feel that there are circumstances that can justify the taking of human life. That is something that I could never admit.
For those of you who have your hands up, I ask you to hold just another minute. We have another person who would like to speak from personal experience, and that's Pastor Bill Jeffs.
I don't want to make any speeches here. Some of you in this conference ground have been observers of one of our children, Connie, Down syndrome, mongoloid, 12 years old, this coming Friday. I asked my wife whether I could say these few things, and I think they're relevant. The time that Connie was born, we didn't have the potential to reach into the sack which surrounds a fetus to take from that fluid to be able to discern whether that particular child with Down syndrome would be able to function in society at all. We have that potential now. I worked in the state of California for abortion reform, which took place 2 years ago. I'm caught in a dilemma. I will not buy Dr. Iben's point of view, namely that abortion is a population-controlling device. I think it is a social ethical device which must be held in the situational ethic setting. Since the birth of Connie, and we practice birth control with the devices that are available, there have been two spontaneous abortions, one which almost cost the life of my wife. Now, we can philosophize all we like, and we can talk about when does life begin, but the growing gulf and the toll in human resource that the child that we love very dearly has taken upon us and our family and those associated with us is phenomenal. That doesn't mean it's not worthwhile. The question that I see as primary is whether or not, when we know and have scientific, sociological, psychological evidence that this will impair not only the individual, but living individuals who also have a right to exist and not be destroyed, either psychologically or in any other way. When we have that capacity as human beings, and we do not use it, are we not then held responsible for this action just as well as the taking of the life of a fetus, if you want to call it that life? Now, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the toll personally for us has been fantastic and continues to be, and that the problems that are inherent in bringing this kind of life into the world knowingly, I think, are going to have to be dealt with not on any kind of rationale basis of philosophy of the ages, but on a base of a humanism which lets me also exist and not be destroyed.
Robin Madison, LSM president.
I'd like to make a comment on what Dr. Hegel has said. I can't personally, or I don't think it's possible to separate the issues of birth control and abortion when the present social reality means that it is more feasible for those who are wealthy and educated to get birth control information and methods. And in saying, putting a distinction between birth control and abortion, and not including abortion as another method of birth control, is saying that the poor and the uneducated who wouldn't have this other information are then, you know, is then told that they are not able to have an abortion when they are probably the ones who are most unable to take care of an unwanted child. And I think this present social reality has to be considered. And through that, I cannot separate those two issues. So if you'd like to comment on that.
Father Peter Hegel.
Trip ya. I'll comment on anything. I agree with you. This is a problem, and this is one of the drawbacks that those who are opposed to abortion must face, that the alternatives to abortion are not presently pragmatic realities. Information, birth control information. Now, for example, I believe, or at least it's possible, that if abortion is legalized, here we are simply making birth control information less available. I think we need to, yes, get birth control information out and get people limiting their families for various reasons, ecological reasons, for quality of life reasons, for all of these. I'm for all of these things. But it's the means, I believe. I just think abortion is a short-sighted, and Vespers, I believe. I don't know the gentleman who preached the sermon, but I think he made a very valid and beautiful point in his sermon, and that means that the short range that we're so prone to take all the time to our own detriment in the long range. And I think abortion is one of these. I think we're all for increasing the quality of human life, but I think if abortion is legalized, through this practice of abortion, we are going to be downgrading human life and really, in the long run, destroying the quality of human life. So I agree with you, right. At the present time, there's the difference between the rich and the poor, and we've got to overcome these problems, not overlook them, but overcome them.
Scott Cady, you said before,
you wouldn't impose your values on other people, and by opposing birth control laws that would allow abortion, you are imposing your theology and your values on these women.
No, I have one vote. She has one vote. I can't allow her to impose hers on me either.
In the back, Leo. My name is Leo Treadway. First of all, I'd like to apologize if I begin to sound a little bit emotional here, but I have been troubled ever since this panel began speaking about something that I consider to be a very important issue. And abortion is only tangentially connected with this. I was appalled at what I consider to be the absolute lack of concern for life. And by life, I mean a much broader definition than what the member of the panels have been describing. It is my feeling that talking about when life begins, when we become human, is really a very superficial and spurious issue. I have no qualms. I can accept the fact that life either begins when the sperm and the egg unite, or before then is a continuing process, whatever. However, I feel that many of the comments today have been directed towards this issue of when life begins, whether we can do an end run and justify an abortion. My concern as a counseling psychologist is with human lives. And I feel that there are many human lives involved in an abortion. There is quite obviously the child, and it is my feeling that the child deserves not only life, but also liberty and the pursuit of happiness, which we tended to ignore, emphasizing only the first. I feel that life is something more than perhaps just living, and if there is some confusion in terminology there, I apologize. I feel there is much more to life than simply the uniting of the egg and the sperm. And I feel that given today's situation, the situation of the world and society, that if we cannot bring a child into the world in which it can fulfill its potential or its blueprint, if you would, that we do that child a very great disservice. The more limiting the factors, the more wrong we do the child. I think that is probably a primary consideration. Secondly, I think in terms of the parents, and for what the young lady in the front row said here, I can only wholeheartedly agree with you. If this problem is severe and creates a great problem of emotional or psychological health for the mother, or for the father, or for both together, then I think abortion is something which should be considered. I speak for abortion because I think that given the exponential increase of problems, and however you want to put it, while it is perhaps not the best solution at present, it is one of reality with which we are faced. And if we really are concerned with human life, we will stop senseless arguments about when life begins, when we become human, face reality, and say to ourselves, if we are really concerned about that child, if we are really concerned about the mother and the father, then abortion is something that we should look at very carefully. And for what Kathy said earlier, I can only say right on. She's one of the few people this morning that I think has really addressed herself to the problem. Thank you.
Dr. Galen Iben.
I just want to clarify myself. Now, I want to make myself clear. I did not advocate abortion as a means of population control. I think I qualified by saying a backup measure. And I think we are talking here about a reverence for life, and I have to wholeheartedly agree with what we've just heard. This goes much deeper than just considerations for the embryo, but we have to consider the quality of life for that child after it is born. And the principle that Father Hagel mentions, I think we are faced here with choosing How do we call this principle again? Okay. Now we choose the safer course. And I think the main difference of opinion here, and what it boils down to, is this. I think in general, biologists that are interested in population say the safer course is to limit that population. The alternatives are for us too terrifying in terms of our reverence for life. So I am not advocating abortion as an only means of population control. What I'm saying is it should be a backup measure. Presently, we don't have. The pill is our best method, and you have heard congressional hearings on this. There are reservations about this, but I still think it's the lesser of two evils, but it's not 100% by any means.
Gil Doan, National Lutheran Campus Ministry, offices in Chicago.
Thank you. I want to register a deep unease, not so much about the ways in which the issue is solved by both the first and the fourth speakers, but something about the character of the thinking which informs their conclusions. I have a great deal of trouble with the apotheosizing or the absolutizing of life as an abstraction apart from God who gives it. It was, as a matter of fact, as I tried to argue a couple days ago, dealing with the creation apart from a recognition and worship of the one who gave it and loves it that got us into trouble with industry and commerce. I haven't heard I shouldn't expect anywhere on the panel to hear this, but we haven't paid much attention to the one who gives life, apart from whom, for me at least, the rest doesn't make much sense. The same kind of problem I have with the first speaker. He clearly, if I heard him, asked for a theological or moral justification for what seems to us obviously the rational thing to do. It seems to me precisely that kind of argument which sustains Lynn White's criticism that it is the Christians who are responsible for the plunder of the earth. They decided it was rational to do it, and they cast about for a handy theological explanation, and they found it, and there were theologians ready to supply it. That makes me very uneasy, not when we deal now with the care of the earth, but with the care of lives that are given to us as human beings from God. I hope, I haven't an answer, but I want to register that unease about the way in which we attack the problem.
Dr. Baker responds.
This illustrates the difficulty that human beings are faced with in life. If I may say, I think all theology arises and has arisen out of man's attempt to find higher justification for what he wants to do. Now, obviously, this may be perceived and interpreted as a cynical, secularist kind of a point of view. It seems to me a very pragmatic one nonetheless. Personally, I would choose to look at this issue as I do all of life, namely from the human point of view. Whatever else we may think man may be or become, he first of all is a product of earth. Whatever may be the origin and source of life, the quality of life that a human being lives is very much conditioned by the quality of his animal organism. Which is to say that a woman who is over 35 years of age is highly unlikely to produce a child, that is to say the statistics against the probability of her producing a child who is capable organically of the full kind of human existence which we are talking about is rather low. The incidence of mongoloidism is considerably higher, as an example, above 35. The same thing may be said for a woman who is pregnant below the age of 19. Increasingly below the age of 19, the statistical probability of her producing an organism capable of full human existence decreases. What I'm saying is the quality of human life, which is of concern, the capacity to love, to interact wholesomely, healthfully with one another, is not just something that comes to us from out of the blue. It's something that is developed on the base of the physiology which we have. I'm saying, therefore, that the concern for the quality of human existence includes the questions of when and when not is it moral for a woman to produce another organism who has the potential or lack of it of full human existence. So I think I would take the thing then from primarily a humanist point of view.
Father Peter Hagel.
I think your criticism or consideration here is a very valid one. I, perhaps as a priest, should take spiritual, more spiritual outlook towards this whole thing. But I have found in dealing with this question that immediately when you start talking about from the spiritual point of view, the spiritual dimension of man and the soul and God, people simply turn you off. I personally see this as a very, very valid dimension of this question. And yet, that's why I said at the very beginning, I really don't need, personally, to consider these things. I do, but I don't need to consider them. I believe there is sufficient grounds and evidence merely on the humanist, from the humanist point of view alone, to stand opposed to abortion. Now, certainly, we can go into the whole question of souls and salvation, God, giver of life, man trying to play God here, and all these things, but the reason I did not and do not even enter into this in a group discussion, and perhaps I should have, because we are Christian, all of us who are here, but if I do it on the college or on the campus, we'd be dealing with, you know, tremendous pluralism here, ranging all the way from atheism to devout Christians, so I avoid taking this approach or even these considerations. But I agree with you, it's a very valid consideration and really necessary for a well-rounded view of the whole thing, because I think that is part of the reality that we're dealing with too.
Steve Piccini.
I have two concerns I want to present, and the first is the consideration of abortions as, in our society, one of those commodities, one of those goods and services that can be produced. And I think I have to disagree with Father Hagel. When he says that the state should have some control over whether it's legal or not legal to produce a certain commodity. In a free enterprise system such as ours, you produce a commodity, and that means that different people, if they have the money and the will, can buy it, can buy that particular good or service. Now, in capitalism, this commodity standing of goods and services as well as products makes everything available to people who have money. It makes pornography available, you know. It makes the supersonic transport available. It makes defense spending available. You know, the government decided that they would set Seattle up as a Boeing plant and then pulled out. And so where's Seattle now, you know? It also makes a possibility for more than one church to exist. You know, when people have their money, they can take their choice. So it seems that where there's a market for something, that's going to happen. Now, I have to reject the proposition that the state has any control over life. We, you know, there's a type of older idea when the state was regarded as beneficent, that it was around to protect life. But lately, that proposition can be contested. The draft is one example of cheap manpower being put at the service of a group who has some money. I already touched on the defense industry in Seattle. There's a great debate going on in this country about drugs, their use, the legality of their use, who should have control of their use. Just as there was, 40, 50 years ago now, about the use of alcohol. The state at one time tried to limit the use of alcohol, and that failed because there was still a market for it no matter what the state said. It seems that if people want and can pay for, you know, the draft, if they want and can pay for the tremendous amount of defense that we've got, if the people want and can pay for drugs, people want and pay for alcohol, people want and pay for sex, if they want and pay for pornography, in our society, that should be able to happen. The other consideration, that's one set of thoughts. The other consideration is that I think that we should consider birth control and abortion as stops along a particular line. When people get together and they have sex, if they choose, try some form of birth control. Now, there's no form of birth control that's 100% effective, so that means that there's always the possibility of conception. And so now we can sort of look at the life that's conceived. It can be either a good child or a bad child, in someone's terminology. Under the bad children, there are those that organically just can't make it. You know, physiologically just can't make it. There, I suppose, are only a few of us who would argue that abortion should not be available to people who would want to terminate the life of a being which just can't make it as a human. The other side, Leo's argument, where the parents perceive that there are going to be some kind of fantastic limitation or coercion on the future life of this child, I think is a case where abortion should be considered more carefully.